just how long have people tried to study the night sky and work out what it all means?
Kepler that really took those laws and then was like, okay, so how does that apply to planets and their orbits?
It's a geared astronomical calculator from the first century BC.
Hello and welcome to the Supermassive podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society with me, science journalist Izzy Clark and astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst.
Last month was all about the future of astronomy, so this month we're going back in time.
I know, the Royal Astronomical Society does not have a TARDIS and to my knowledge Becky hasn't discovered a time-bending wormhole. Yes?
Not yet, at least. To my disappointment, because Chris Hemsworth hasn't popped out of one either. Like, for Natalie Portman in Thor.
Keep working on that, please.
I will. You know, this was what was sold to me as the life of an astrophysicist, and I'm still waiting for it. No. We're actually looking at the history of astronomy today. So how, historically, we've studied the universe and our place in it.
Here with us, as always, is Dr. Robert Massey, the Deputy Director of the Royal Astronomical Society. So, Robert, what is the oldest piece in the Royal Astronomical Society's archive? Because you have loads of stuff.
We do have loads of stuff. And of course, the obvious thing to do, which I did, was check with our librarian, Dr. Sharon Prosser. And she referred me to a book dating from 1472 called De Natura Rerum, On the Nature of Things, written by Isidora of Seville. And it's a reprint because Isidora of Seville died in 636. Wow. So already by the time this was published, it was more than 800 years old, despite being 550, am I getting that right, years old now. So it's the oldest printed book that we have, and it's a short treatise on physics, astronomy, and geography. I have seen this on display, and it's fascinating to look at because what you realise is these are incredibly lavish works. I mean, they're obviously a very small minority of people own books at the time. And you can see it has these wonderful, almost cut-out models and rotating disks. And another description of the book has been the Book of Wheels, just to illustrate the way that things are in the sky. And they were obviously thinking about a geocentric universe at the time, the Earth at the centre of the universe. But amazing thing to see. So occasionally we have that on display, either for special scientific conferences or sometimes when we have things like open house in the autumn. So do look out for that. Actually, if you're anywhere near London, we'll have our building open in September. We might have things like that on display. I'm not promising it because Sharon won't be happy, but that's the kind of thing.
Sean fending off people like no, stop asking me for the book.
Indeed, she won't thank me if I make this pledge.
Put your grabby hands away.
Exactly. There are real limits to who gets to handle it as well.
Well, thanks, Robert. We'll catch up with you later in the show, as usual, for our listener questions.
So I think we can all say that at one point or another, we've looked up at the night sky, taken in the view, and have been filled with awe. And then swiftly followed by a lot of questions. So just how long have people tried to study the night sky and work out what it all means? Editor Richard Hollingham spoke with our friend, journalist Dr. Stuart Clark, author of Beneath the Night, How the Stars Have Shaped the History of Humankind, for a whistle-stop tour through history.
The evidence, depending on who you believe, could date back to around about 20,000 years ago. There's one particular artifact called the Ishango bone, and this is a fossilized baboon bone that was found in the 1960s in Congo. And it has these markings on it, and they're not really aesthetic markings. They're maybe more like tally marks, somebody counting something. And there are all sorts of ideas for what that might be that they're counting. One of the ideas is that it's some sort of lunar calendar. And so it's a sort of a timekeeping device. And there are other sort of ancient artifacts as well, which some people look at and interpret in these kinds of ways. So we don't know for absolutely certain, and there are other things, you know, that these could be, but that sort of evidence dates back into essentially prehistoric times.
And why would that be? Why would you need a lunar calendar?
So I think one of the first and most obvious uses, if you like, for the night sky is timekeeping. You know, we get our night and day from the movement of the sun. We get our month from the moon, and we get our year from the positions of the stars. And keeping a tally, I suppose, of where you are in that period and where you are in that time frame, because that helps with the seasons. The seasons appear to tally with what's going on as well. There are also certain social gatherings that we believe that these ancient people would have tied in time to the winter solstice or other astronomical configurations. And, you know, without watches and clocks, those were the kind of clues, visual clues that you had to tell the time and know when to, maybe you have to travel across the country to a certain specific gathering or something like that.
What about the stars? I mean, we have to talk about when's the evidence that they started to become important or significant to particular civilizations.
Yeah, so those, again, they're linked, if you like. The correlation that's noticed is that the patterns of the constellations change throughout the year, and that mirrors the seasons. And so there are a lot of ceremonies that celebrate the reappearance of certain stars or certain star groupings. So in New Zealand, for example, there's the Matariki ceremony, which is the reappearance of the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters star cluster, and then the next new moon after that reappearance of the Pleiades is the Maori New Year. In ancient Egypt, Sirius would rise just before the Nile flooding season. And so there was thought to be some sort of correlation there. And in fact, we still use a phrase that derives from those times, which are the dog days of summer. And when we say that, we mean the very hottest times of the summer. And that comes from Sirius, the dog star in Canis Major. And the idea was that, well, heat obviously comes from the sun. Sirius is the brightest star in the night sky. And so when Sirius is above the horizon, perhaps its heat was also adding to the Egyptian summers. And that's why it was the hottest time of the year. And so those are the dog days of summer.
That's fantastic. Let's talk then about a bit more about Egypt. And I think we need to bring in gods here, because there was a tie-up inevitably between the night sky and religion. Talk about the sun in ancient Egypt, because I love the way that features and the way that ties in with the gods and what's going on in the heavens.
Yeah, and I think when you take a step backwards and just think about the sun, it's so reasonable that they placed so much emphasis, you know, and godlike power into the sun, because of course it gives life to the planet. Sunlight drives life, and so it seems obvious that it's the life giver, it's the supreme deity, the supreme force that's controlling everything that's going on the earth. And then, of course, where does it go at night? Well, they have this concept of Nut, the sky goddess, who has the stars painted on her torso. And she swallows the sun at the end of the day. And the sun traverses through her body during the night and is reborn at dawn in the mornings. So this idea of the gods and these extremely remote places of power that somehow influence life on Earth is prevalent right from the very sort of first recorded writings, which come from the Mesopotamia region. And there was a city there called Kesh, and the Kesh Temple hymn, one of the earliest pieces of writing, and it celebrates the link between the Earth and the heavens and the night sky, and suggests really that the temple there is the link between those two realms. The other thing that's interesting that happens in the Egyptian period is the Book of the Dead. And this is the wide-scale way for people to get to heaven, as it were. It develops over centuries, in fact. And first of all, it's only the pharaohs that can ever go up into the night sky and join Ra on his golden chariot crossing the sky every day. And then gradually, access to this starry heavenly realm kind of becomes democratized. And the writings of how to get to follow the stars to get to heaven that you see on the pyramid walls in the burial chambers in the pyramids, they gradually become included in coffins, on the lids, the inside of the lids of coffins for sort of lower and lower classes of people. So access to heaven is democratized, but at the same time, the idea of judgment on whether you are worthy to get into heaven or not comes in for the very first time, and the idea of weighing of the heart to see if you're pure enough to enter heaven or whether you are devoured by some kind of demonic monster at that point.
When you look at those writings and writings later than that and mapping out the stars, are they accurate? Can we use those as an accurate portrayal of how the stars were, how the cosmos was, and how it looked like to people thousands of years ago?
So the ancient Egyptians, for example, they don't use the constellations that we use. In fact, they use much smaller groupings of stars and these little asterisms. You know, we find them on our temples and on carvings, but we can't correlate them with the stars that we see today. They're just too generic, you know, maybe a triangle of stars or something like that. The constellations that we use, however, they were sort of enshrined by the Greeks and classical antiquity. But they almost certainly came from this Mesopotamia region, the sort of the Fertile Crescent and the very first civilizations that sprang up there. And one of the most interesting things for me are the paintings in the caves at Lascaux. There's the Hall of the Bulls, where there's this one picture of this sort of ancient bull-like creature, an Uruk, and there are dots that surround it. And if you look at the dots, there's a cluster of dots on its face, a cluster of dots above its shoulder, and then following its eye line, there's a little line of dots. They are excellent representations of the constellations of Taurus and possibly Orion as well. So the eye of the bull on this cave painting, you know, 19,000 years old cave painting, looks as if it could be the Hyades star cluster, with the eye itself being Aldebaran, the star we see as the eye of the bull today. Above the shoulder of this cave painting, another cluster of dots that could be the Pleiades, the seven sisters. A good positional representation for where they are today. And then this line of stars is in about the right place for Orion's belt, but there's four stars on the cave painting, not three. But there it is, Taurus, an actual depiction of a bull and these dots that could be the stars. Other people think there are other interpretations of all, we'll never know, but it is tantalising to wonder.
It's a good point to bring in a question, actually, from our Instagram, and apologies for mangling this name. Anjali Vitu Redkar asks on Instagram, how did ancient Asian civilization understand the universe? So we talked about sort of Mesopotamia, what's now the kind of Middle East, Iran, that sort of Egypt area. What about Asia?
Yeah, this is fascinating as well. And they interpreted the night sky from their own sort of cultural beliefs. So, for example, the Chinese, I looked this up, and I'm going to read this out so that I don't get this wrong, because these are lovely sounding things. So they split the northern celestial hemisphere into three different regions. And because they were a highly imperial culture, where the emperor and the imperial palace was the centre of Chinese or that culture society, the celestial representation of the imperial palace was up near the northern celestial pole, and that was called the Purple Forbidden Enclosure. The imperial court, so one removed from that, was another part of the sky, which was the Supreme Palace Enclosure, and then surrounding that was the Heavenly Market Enclosure, so all the rest of the surrounding lands. And what is fascinating is that each of the cultures that we look at interpreted the night sky and the various different comings and goings of the stars in some way that was related to their own comings and goings. And I think that thought process even survives in the Christian idea, the adopted Christian idea of, you know, as on earth, so it is in heaven. And people were looking at, and cultures were looking at the night sky to try to make meaning of their lives on earth. It's only much later, millennia later, that they start looking to try and understand what the celestial objects are.
And that, I guess, is my final question. At what point did we start getting it right, rather than imposing sort of our culture on the night sky, if you like, or taking that as part of our realm?
For all of these ancient cultures, they realised that the first step to understanding the wider universe and our place within it was to know the positions of these objects, chart the way they moved. And so we had this traditional positional astronomy for millennia. That begins to change at around about the 16th, 17th century in Europe, where we start to look for reasons why the celestial objects might move in the way that they do. And that brings in the scientific revolution, in which time we start to have dynamics and forces, and we start to understand it in a very Newtonian way. And then only in the 19th century do we have the breakthrough with spectroscopy in Heidelberg in 1859, which means that we can actually start to analyse the celestial objects for their composition and their physical characteristics and know them as places, as it were. So it's very, very late in the day, comparatively, that we start doing what we recognise today as science. But in all of those ancient times in the past, they were doing a form of science, as they would think of it, to try to understand more about the universe. It's just their terms of reference were very different from ours.
Thank you to Dr. Stuart Clark. So, Becky, is there a particular era that fascinates you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's sort of like the end of the 1910s and then through the 1920s, which I know was a fairly horrific time for the world in general, but for astronomy, wow, what a time to be alive. In 1915, you've got Einstein publishing his theory of general relativity. So that completely changes how we think about gravity as a whole. But then you've also got, at the same time, the great debate raging, which was this debate between Harlow and Shapley, two astronomers, about the size of the universe, with one believing that the universe was basically just the Milky Way galaxy and everything we could see was maybe, you know, like 100,000 light years away, and then you've got the other arguing that actually, you know, these fuzzy blobs that we see are actually galaxies of stars in their own right, millions of light years away. Yeah. And that actually culminated in an actual debate in 1920 as well. And then through the 20s, you got in 1924, it was Edwin Hubble who actually measured the distances to these fuzzy blobs using Leavitt's law and found that they were actually galaxies in their own right. And I can't even imagine living through that era of just going from sort of, you know, this thing about, oh, my entire world view changed. Yeah, what universe, your entire universe view changed, you know, where you've gone from thinking that everything is sort of so close by to being so much bigger, like in terms of you as a human, you have shrunk so much more, right, in terms of what we believe to be the scale of the universe. And then, of course, just a few years later, 1929, Hubble then also says that the galaxies that are further away from us are moving away from us faster. And so we have the first evidence for the universe expanding. So in the space of what, like 10, 15 years, you've gone from, hey, the universe is just the Milky Way, to, hey, it's much bigger. Oh, hey, it's getting bigger all the time.
I mean, talk about a game changer. Like, what a fascinating couple of decades. But I think it's something, you know, from researching this entire episode, is something that we take for granted is how much information we have now today, but the history and the work that has gone into understanding that, and that it wasn't always the case for people. I think you can forget that. I mean, I certainly can.
Yeah, one fact I love is that we didn't know that black holes existed when we put a man on the moon in 1960.
Yeah, like we
didn't.
What?
Like, we didn't know we're all orbiting one at the center of the Milky Way, right? Like at that point, it was that wasn't until like the late 90s that was accepted. And I, you know, just toddle around in my day job going, there's a black hole at the center of every galaxy. And just, it's such a sentence I take for granted. And you have to remember, like, literally the 100, 200 years worth of research that led up to that point, right? And that's why I love sort of the history of science so much, is just being reminded of these facts. Now, an important phase in the history of Western astronomy lies with the Greeks. Most of the stars, planet, constellation names of the Northern Hemisphere come from the terminology of Greek astronomy. It was an era where we started to see astronomers use geometry to try and understand the night sky.
And with that comes the introduction of mechanisms to help them. One such device is called the Antikythera mechanism. It's essentially a mechanical device they use to calculate the positions of astronomical objects. And luckily for us, the president of the Royal Astronomical Society, Professor Mike Edmonds, heads the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project. It's an international collaboration investigating this extraordinary astronomical machine.
Well, it's a geared astronomical calculator, really, from the first century BC, made out of bronze. It was found in a shipwreck around 1900 and has always been since then in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens. It was clear, unless we had new experimental data on the thing, we were not going to be able to work out exactly what it did.
Describe what this looks like. Is it something that you could hold in your hand, or is it, you know, a big mechanism?
This one was undoubtedly the handheld, well, not handheld model, but the miniature model, if you like to put it that way. It's about the size of a shoebox. If you imagine a shoebox stood up on its end, that's its size. Now, on the front, there is a dial that shows you the position of the sun and moon in the zodiac. Remember, the zodiac is the band of the sky around which the sun and moon move. We believe probably it also showed the position of the known planets at that time, but that bit of the mechanism, unfortunately, is missing. On the back of the device, there were two spiral dials, quite intricate. On the back at the top was a spiral dial showing a calendrical cycle, the metonic cycle, which is basically a cycle of new and full moons. What it says, basically, is in 235 lunar months, that's full moon to full moon, there are almost exactly 19 years. So this dial will tell you what, basically, when full moon and is going to be, what date it's going to fall on.
So this device was able to track 19 years in one of its dials.
Yes. I mean, it's a fairly simple arithmetic relationship, but a useful thing if you want to be able to set out when you're going to have full moon, new moon for religious, political, whatever purposes. On the bottom dial, there was, again, a similar sort of cycle, but this was to do with eclipses. It's a 223 month Saros cycle. And what happens if you have an eclipse that occurs, either a solar or a lunar eclipse, which could only happen at full or new moon? Well, exactly 223 lunar months later, you'll get a similar eclipse, but shifted in time by 8 hours. Now, you don't always see eclipses from the same place, as you know, particularly for solar eclipses. But this dial, which we assume is based on Babylonian observations over time of when there had been eclipses before, can then give you a fairly good idea of when to look out that it's likely that an eclipse might occur that month.
Incredible. That's what I wanted to ask you. How would the Greeks have known what to program and how to build this mechanism and have that fundamental understanding of the world around us and the planets and, you know, the phases of the moon?
Well, there's a long tradition. It goes back way, way beyond the Greeks, way, way beyond the Babylonians. And the sites like Stonehenge show clear evidence of knowing about the solstices and therefore the seasonal movements we see from Earth. And the Babylonians, who were before the Greeks and partly contemporary with them, were very good observers, and just naked eye observers, but they kept very good records and worked out what the sequences of things were. Now, the Greeks got into sort of being more mathematical, more geometrical, and began to be able to make models and predictions and so on and mathematize the observations in different ways. And interesting enough, that this, as I say, this mechanical device was putting this knowledge into mechanical form. And it's interesting to conjecture how far that went and whether, in fact, putting stuff into mechanical form
could have pushed their mathematics a bit. If you start thinking about things mechanically, you think about things mathematically in a different way. So there may have been some symbiosis there.
And so when you turn to study this more recently, how did you do that? You know, what sort of scans did you run and what did it find?
Basically, we used two major techniques. One was computed X-ray tomography, which basically is just like giving it a body scan, a three-dimensional body scan. You have to use fairly high-energy X-rays, and we were very lucky that a firm in existence at that time called X-Tech, now part of Nikon, lent us a machine to do that. The other technique was to do very, very detailed surface imaging with image processing to bring out all the small detail. One of the great things about this device, it not only has these dials, but it has an awful lot of Greek text in and on it, which we were able to read, which helped with the interpretation. Basically, inside, there are gear trains, at least 33 gears with a main calendrical and solar dials. We worked out pretty well. I mean, a lot of work had been done before, but the actual whole trains hadn't been worked out, and now everybody agrees about them. And perhaps the most interesting one, if I can talk for a moment about that, is the lunar train, the one that displays the lunar position in the zodiac on the front and also shows the lunar phase.
Wow. So what did it show?
The lunar phase was shown by a half-coloured ball. It sort of had two hemispheres. You've seen it on old clocks and goodness knows what, but the invention goes back way, way into the past, so it'll show you what the lunar phase was. Now, the pointer on the dial showing where the moon was quite a complicated train of gears, and it had in it a little variable speed device because the moon does not move at the same rate throughout the month. Because as we know now, the lunar orbit is an ellipse, and sometimes it moves faster in the sky, sometimes slower. And the gearing had a device that did that, that allowed the motion to move slightly faster, slightly slower. I must emphasize, what you're doing is you're turning a dial on the side of this device to turn all this stuff. And so whether you'd actually see this difference in rate, I don't know, but you might just about be able to perceive the difference in rate. But it was in there. And what was so amazingly clever about this, not that it was a mechanical device to give the variable speed, but that little device of four gears was mounted on another gear. What that did was made sure that not only was the amplitude of the variation right, but the period of the variation was right, which is different for the normal lunar month, because the ellipse of the moon's orbit precesses and it changes the period of this variation. So it's a very, very subtle and beautifully mechanically designed gear train.
It's absolutely amazing. So what would something like this likely to be used for?
To be honest with you, we don't really know. We've got quite a lot of references in classical literature to the existence of such devices. It wasn't a one-off. There would have been others of these. There'd have been more simple ones and so on. So there were undoubtedly quite a few of these devices around. We don't think it was probably a computer for an astronomer to make really accurate calculations. I've done some work on trying to work out how accurate it would have been, and it was pretty good. But if you'd used it for, say, for predicting a new moon, you'd be out typically by a day or two. So what is it? Is it a teaching device? That's a possible. Was it something you displayed in a temple? That's possible, I suppose. The one I like probably best is that it's a statement. It's a statement about what we know about the universe. And maybe that's something that people would pay money for to have on their mantle shelf to show, look, I'm really interested in the universe. Here's what's currently known about it. And what is also very interesting about this, the astronomy that is in this device is exactly right for around 100 BC. There's a book by a guy called Geminos called The Phenomenon, and the astronomy in that book from around 100 BC is almost exactly the same as the astronomy that is in this mechanism. So we've got very good reason to believe that this is what they knew about current astronomy. And maybe it was just a way of displaying what they knew about the current state of the universe.
Finally, are there any questions that you still want to uncover when it comes to the Antikythera mechanism?
Well, the things one would like to know is how they displayed the planets. We've got a good idea, but that part of the mechanism is missing. It would be interesting to know how they did it. It would be interesting to know why they did this, what it really was used for, would be fun. And, of course, the other interesting thing would be, did they have any other kind of mechanical device that we don't know about? We'll just have to wait and see if somebody found one, I suppose. And if I can make one last comment, one of the fascinating things I find is that at that time, Greek astronomy knew an awful lot about the motion of the planets, but they didn't know why. And interestingly enough, we've come to the same state again in cosmology. We've got an awful lot of information about the way the universe is behaving, its increasing acceleration, its dark matter, dark energy. But again, we're back to a state where we don't know why. Let's hope it's not another 1,500 years before somebody works it out.
This is the Supermassive Podcast from the Royal Astronomical Society, with me, astrophysicist Dr. Becky Smethurst, and with science journalist Izzy Clark.
This month, we're attempting to travel through time to understand the history of astronomy. Before we get to our listener questions, though, I think we've covered quite a lot of ancient history here, but when did we start having a fully mathematical understanding of our universe? Robert, Becky, who were the key figures in that?
Well, it's an interesting question, actually, in how you define fully mathematical. Because even if you look back 1,000 years, you've got people like Ibn al-Harith, an Egyptian astronomer, who developed things like Fermat's theorem and the laws in optics, and also tried to develop a mathematical understanding of the solar system, you know, albeit sort of aligned to this model still of the Earth being at the centre of the universe. But the seminal change, I guess, comes in the European Renaissance when you look at the invention of the telescope, which was a huge driver, and the century before that, when you've got things like Copernicus re-establishing the idea of the sun being at the centre of the universe, or the solar system at least, and then moving on to people like Kepler and Galileo and Newton, and, you know, attempting to, a combination of observation, developing mathematical theories, actually for the first time making it possible to predict much more accurately where things were. One figure I always want to mention as well is Thomas Harriot, who's overlooked, but was the first person to draw an image of the moon through a telescope back in 1609, and we celebrated him back in 2009, now 14 years ago, when we had the International Year of Astronomy commemorating events like that. And the only reason I mention him is because he was working in West London, and not a lot of people know that he lived and worked in Sion House for quite a long time doing that there. So there's this seminal figure in astronomy that is slightly overlooked.
And so that Renaissance era, the European Renaissance era, that's what, 15th, 16th century?
Yeah, and it's the move from Copernicus onwards, I think. You know, Copernicus heretically publishing his theory, his idea that the sun was at the centre of the solar system on his deathbed, or in the year that he died, yeah. And then it becoming more acceptable to talk about it. And by the middle of the 17th century, it's widely accepted.
And I think that's why Kepler sweeps in a little bit. And I think Kepler is so well known inside astronomy circles, but not to the same degree as like Newton is outside of astronomy circles. So I think everyone always knows Newton for sort of, you know, this writing down the maths of sort of gravity and how you could calculate that. But it was Kepler that really took those laws and then was like, okay, so how does that apply to planets and their orbits? Mm. And then how can we then calculate using that where they're going to be and predict where they're going to be? And then that led to people realizing there's something wrong with Mercury's orbit. And hey, our laws of gravity don't match Mercury. And then that led to obviously Einstein's theory of general relativity as well with gravity. So you can see all the little dominoes, you know, that have to fall when you look back at sort of this history of astronomy, especially that this first effort and push to put things down into the maths.
It's time to get onto our listener questions. There have been so many interesting ones. So let's see what we get here. So Robert, Jack D. Maher on Twitter asks, what big astronomical discoveries were more recent than people would expect them to be?
Well, Jack, I mean, Becky's already referred to black holes, which I think is a great example. But my choice, I think, would probably be exoplanets, planets in orbit around other stars, because despite the canon of science fiction, all the, you know, the science fiction films that we've had for decades, you would imagine from those that we'd known for sure about planets around other stars for a long time. But actually, the first one was only discovered back in 1992, and that was a pretty exotic example of planets going around a pulsar, around a neutron star, the remnant of a supernova explosion. But since then, in only the last 30 years, we've discovered more than 5,000, and there are hundreds more candidates waiting to be confirmed. So, you know, you would think from all the conversations, you know, you would imagine, oh yeah, of course we knew that there were lots of planets around other stars. Of course we know the solar system's not unique. And I think astronomers were almost all certain that was the case. But it took a very long time to confirm it for sure. And now suddenly it seems really, really easy. You know, it's one of those paradigm shifts where you go from, oh, you know, it's really hard. Do we ever know for sure there are planets around other stars? To, oh, yeah, there are thousands of them. And actually, if we look around, there are billions and billions. We just haven't found them yet.
For me, it's also the growth of the size of that field within the past couple of like decades as well. So I started my PhD in 2013, so 10 years ago. And even back then, there was, you know, there's a few people studying exoplanets, but the field wasn't that big. Whereas now it feels like, oh, my, everybody's doing exoplanets. And you can see that reflected in like JWST proposals as well. Like 30% of JWST proposals are for exoplanets. And yeah, okay, it was sort of built with that science goal in mind. But like, it just shows you like from 95 onwards, like as Robert was saying.
Yeah. And even from last month when we were talking about the future of observatories, how many of the future observatories will also be looking into exoplanets, chemical compositions and things like that. So, yeah, it's...
And that quest for an Earth-like, a genuinely Earth-like planet around another star or something habitable,
or
biosignatures, at least, you know,
or whatever it might be.
Just tantalizingly close. You know, I mean, I made this silly prediction. I think in about 2000, I thought, oh yeah, by 2020, we'll definitely know for sure if there are other Earth-like planets. And well, there you go. Don't make predictions. I
feel like we've got like the one that's the most...
We've got
sort of like Earth size. We've got the one that's the most Earth mass. We've got the one that's orbiting the most sun-like star. But we haven't got the Venn diagram of all of those three.
It's
right?
Almost. It's that little bit in the middle of the Venn diagram that isn't quite filled in, isn't it?
Okay, and Becky, Ginny Yin wants to know, how many different ways did people try and figure out the speed of light?
Very many, Ginny, and I hope you'll forgive me for the book plug. But in my book, A Brief History of Black Holes, there's a whole chapter on measuring the speed of light as well, because it's obviously a key idea when you think about black holes as well. But if we think about sort of the big experiments, you know, you've got Galileo, who I guess is sort of the first recorded written experiment of someone trying to do this with basically two lamps on hilltops. And it was sort of people, you know, revealing their lamp and not revealing the lamp and trying to time when you actually saw the other person revealing the light from the lamp or not. But the two hilltops weren't separated by a great enough amount for human reaction time to be able to record the speed that the light actually arrived at. I guess the next person to mention is Ole Rømer, who actually did this off the back of something that Galileo was doing. Galileo was trying to give people a way of determining what longitude you were at, essentially to try and work out time zones with sort of the advent of, you know, the discovery of the New World, people wanting to know, okay, what time is it in, you know, Spain? What time is it in Brazil? You know, that kind of thing. With the motivation being trying to find your longitude, you know, with the advent of a lot more exploration around the world on ships, he realized that you could use a moon of Jupiter, Io. It orbits every 42 hours. That's essentially a clock that you can use to work out, okay, if I know the time here, I can know my time where I am in the world from how much more delayed Io reappearing behind and in front of Jupiter is. I can work out how much of a delay that is and therefore how far around the Earth I am. Of course, he didn't really think about the fact that you're on a moving ship trying to work out when Io is appearing and disappearing. But the bigger problem was that they realized that throughout the Earth's year, like you could try and measure this in summer and winter and there'd be a strange delay to the when you were sort of seeing Io reappear from behind Jupiter. And basically Ole Rømer was like, right, we got to figure this out, and observed things meticulously and was like, okay, so in winter compared to in summer, there's like a 22-minute delay. And that's basically the time it takes light to travel Earth's orbit. He didn't make that connection. He never actually wrote down that that's what it was, but it was the measurements that then Christian Huygens then used to calculate a value for the speed of light a couple of years later. So this is sort of the end of the 1600s we're talking about now. So Galileo was sort of more like the early 1600s. And then I think the only person we need to mention as well is sort of Hippolyte Fizeau. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I butcher people's names.
Robert gently nodded there, so I think we'll go with that.
Okay, yeah. Who knows? Hippolyte Fizeau. You know. I love what he did to mention it. So he sort of worked on sort of Galileo's principle of like two hilltops, right? And you have this source of light that's fired in between a wheel that has little tooths. So imagine like it's sort of like a cog or a gear. When you fire the light between one tooth, it reflects off a mirror, in this case it was about 8 kilometers away, comes back again, and you can rotate your wheel at a certain speed so that it gets blocked by the next tooth of the wheel.
Right.
And so if you know the distance between sort of the mirror and the distance the light's traveling and then the speed that you're rotating your wheel at, you can then work out the speed of light, which I think was a really clever way of doing it. And obviously they needed, you know, a good distance between the two places of sort of setting off the light and reflecting it back again. But that was in around about 1849 that was sort of it was a very accurate measurement as well. It was around that sort of, you know, like 300,000 kilometers per second mark. But then after that, you then get into sort of, okay, you've got Maxwell's equations now for describing waves, like electromagnetic waves, and you have other fundamental constants that you can then use to work out the speed of light from that. And so people would tend to sort of devolve into that after that, rather than these, you know, incredible, like, we must build this giant toothed wheel to do this. Or expressing the speed of light based on Earth's orbit distance from the sun, which again, it's, you know, you can express the speed of light in that way, but unless you know the distance from the Earth to the sun, it's obviously very difficult to get like a speed in sort of everyday units.
Okay. And Robert Lucy San says, how extensive was the knowledge of astronomy to the Incas?
So the answer is that apparently very much so. You know, the astronomy was very important to the Incas. And there are researchers like Stephen Goldberg, who works for the International Astronomical Union, along with one of the former vice presidents of the RAS, Steve Miller, on ensuring that astronomy respects indigenous peoples. And by that, it's things like making sure that you cite observatories in a respectful way, and you understand that this is not just land that we should appropriate for this use, but that we have that negotiation and consensus and consent of peoples it affects. And the period of time when the Incas were doing this was from roughly the 13th to the 16th century. So the time in the 16th century, obviously you have the Spanish conquest of the South America, Middle America, and, you know, that really destroys that civilization. But we do see phenomenal monuments and temples that remain despite that destruction. But what Stephen's done is explore these monuments and structures in Peru. There's quite a lot still there. And they have monuments and temples that are aligned both to the sun and the moon. So they do things like mark the solstices and equinoxes, like the Neolithic monuments in Europe, where you get, say, a shaft of light going into a building at the solstice sunrise and all those kind of wonderful things. There's really phenomenal pictures, and I absolutely recommend you seek them out. He gave a talk to CERN a few years ago, and there are all these beautiful illustrations of it. One of them, for example, is described as the awakening of the Puma at Kenko Grande in the Cusco Valley, in Peru. And another one has a light tube that lets moonlight in as well to light up the interior. And he also describes that they use the Pleiades. They looked at the appearance of the stars in the Pleiades to determine whether it was a good time to plant based on the weather conditions in the sky. And they align their view of the sky around the Milky Way. And being so far south, if you ever go to the Southern Hemisphere or even just down to the Mediterranean and further south, what you realize is you're in the summer at least, in June, I should say, because in the Southern Hemisphere, the season's the other way around, you would see a much brighter Milky Way. You're looking towards the center of the galaxy. It's much more dominant. And a lot of the cultures in the southern part of the world base their constellations around the Milky Way. They see it as this river running across the sky quite often, including the Incas. And they see the dark clouds, which are genuinely dark clouds of dust in front of the stars, the Milky Way, the interior of our galaxy, and often give those make those constellations as well. So in the case of the Incas, they represented a shepherd, a serpent, a bird, a fox, a toad, a llama, and I particularly like an additional baby llama as well.
Oh, that's great. That is so great.
Like, we have the big bear and the little bear. They have big llama, little llama.
Exactly, yeah. And no, it's stunning. I mean, you must have been down in the Southern Hemisphere, Becky. It's been many years since I did, but, you know, the Milky Way is so dramatic when it's high in the sky like that.
And Becky, there's this question here from Natalia Hearn, who asks, I've read that there are ancient rock carvings in Chile that are believed to depict the Magellanic Clouds. Do you know anything about this or where they are located? So just to explain, the Magellanic Clouds are two irregular dwarf galaxies that you can see in the Southern Hemisphere. So Becky, over to you with the rest.
Yeah, they look sort of like nice little fuzzy blobs, another thing you can see from the Southern Hemisphere. I have sort of heard sort of this before as well. Like, it's been always been the back of my mind that these petroglyphs, these rock carvings in Chile where you have these sort of fuzzy blobs in the Magellanic Clouds. I looked into this though, and I can't find a source that like actually supports this. I can find a lot of articles that just state it with no reference, but nothing like that's in support of it, no images of the actual petroglyphs themselves. So if anybody listening knows anything about this, or if, maybe we can ask also Sean, the librarian, to dive into anything from the RAS archives as well. Because I think this is actually fascinating that they were recording this time, because we could also look at perhaps if they've changed as well. Mm. There is maybe some argument that there was perhaps a third that could have turned into what's now known as the Magellan Extreme. So sort of this idea of them being recorded then might allow you to actually then do this sort of, it's like galactic archaeology, as sometimes it's called as well, from these previous observations. So if anybody does know anything about this, please let us know, because we would love to hear about it.
Yeah, absolutely. So send in any sources that you have or further questions. You can email us at podcast@res.ac.uk, tweet at Royal Astrosoc, or find us on Instagram. It's at supermassivepod. So, Robert, what are some of the things that we can see in the night sky this month?
Well, it's still, you know, the height of summer now, right? And, you know, aren't we enjoying it after that rather chilly spring? Or at least yes, I certainly 100%. Am for now. So in the summer, you know, it's very appropriate to continue doing things if you've got the equipment to do it safely. Look out for sunspots. The sun is still really active. It's quite exciting to see these huge structures on the surface of the sun. Remember, each sunspot you see is typically sort of about the size of the Earth. So put that in perspective if you do look at them. And those other things that you can try and look for, given it doesn't get very dark at night or not for very long, is looking out for those illuminated noctilucent clouds high in the Earth's atmosphere, right up in the northern sky.
Yeah, I saw some the other day.
Did you?
Yeah, I was at a wedding in Cornwall and we were walking back at like, you know, midnight, and it was really dark because we were in the middle of nowhere in Cornwall. And I just looked up and was like, oh, noctilucent clouds. So yeah,
exactly.
There you go. You can see them, people.
They're amazing.
You can see them even while slightly inebriated after a friend's wedding.
Exactly. So there is no barrier. So if you're safely walking back from the pub, have a look in the northern sky carefully. And if you're in a dark enough place, they are really beautiful. I've only seen them really well once, which was when Comet Neowise was around.
Yeah.
They're very obvious when they're there. But better than in the north of England and Scotland, actually, if you're listening to this in the UK or further north in the, you know, in the northern hemisphere, it should be fairly easy to spot. In terms of stuff you can see when it's darkish, Venus is still really obvious. So if you've been looking west recently, I doubt you could have mistaken it. It's so brilliant in the western sky and after sunset, and it's pretty much at its maximum brightness right now. If you look at it with a telescope, it's an obvious crescent. And over the next few weeks, right up towards July, it's going to, or until the end of July, it's going to become a bigger and thinner crescent. And to the extent that you'll be able to see that with a pair of binoculars as well, it'll look like a tiny moon and just gets bigger and bigger, gets lower in the sky, and then it'll pass between the Earth and the Sun, and we obviously won't be able to see it. Mars is still hanging in there after sunset, but it's very small to see any detail. Just worth noting, you can track its progress against the background stars. And the other planets need a really early start. You need to be up well after midnight or very early in the morning to find them. So it's probably better to wait a couple of months longer to see those. But in terms of constellations, as the nights get a bit longer, you start to see more of those summer stars. The Milky Way is visible, certainly towards the end of July by midnight. You know, when the moon's not in the sky, that should start to be really obvious. Stretching up from Scorpius and Sagittarius, the zodiac constellations that are in the direction of the center of the galaxy, and really stunning. And they're packed with stars. And I often say, well, if you are going south for your holidays, even down to the Mediterranean, southern France, they're that bit higher in the sky and they're that bit more obvious. So just take a small pair of binoculars with you and enjoy the view. But even if you're in the UK, if you've got a good southern horizon, they're really obvious. And we see loads of photos this time of year. People go out and they sit in places, for some reason, a lot of the time in Durdle Dor in Dorset is a particularly popular spot, and you see the Milky Way stretching up from the sea there. So, you know, that's another nice thing to try out.
Well, that is perfect timing, because I'm literally just about to go on holiday. So thank you very much, Robert.
Are you going south?
We'll be in Italy, in the heel of Italy. So
what, nice. Take those binoculars.
Yes, they're coming with
and,
me.
And tweet us with some pictures.
I will try.
Remember, your phone's just as good for it, isn't it?
Oh, that's
well?
True.
Like a little 10 or 30-second exposure.
Well, I do have a little travel telescope. I'll see if Ryanair will let me squeeze that on in my hand luggage.
As you know, you can also, there's an app, I think people do now with apps, they actually stack their photos on smartphones. So you can even, if you take a few, that's probably worth trying as well.
Right, well, I think that is it for this episode. There'll be a bonus in a few weeks. And then next time, we're travelling to the sun to find out the latest from the Solar Orbiter mission.
Yeah, I'm really excited for all the interviews going to have for that one because I really want to know what they're up to. And of course, tweet us if you try some astronomy at home. It's at Royal Astrosoc on Twitter, or you can email your questions to podcast@ras.ac.uk and we'll try and cover them in a future episode. But until next time, everybody, happy stargazing.